MSW Media. Hey everybody, it's AG and welcome to Refried Beans, where we play an episode of the Daily Beans podcast from the same week, either 1, 2, or 3 years ago, so we can see how far we've come. So please enjoy this episode from days gone by and note the date in the intro. Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Monday, April 19th, 2021. Today, a founding member of the Oath Keepers, John Schaefer, becomes the insurrection's first cooperating witness. A discussion with Andrew McCabe about the new Kilimnik Manafort evidence. The Department of Justice files a civil suit against Roger Stone for tax evasion. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Rep. Gosar try to start a Ku Klux caucus, then quickly pretend they had nothing to do with it. The insurrection bullhorn lady is chewed out for mocking the court. And a new development in the Gates investigation. Because, Lordy, there are tapes. I'm AG.
And I'm Dana Goldberg.
Dana, it was just like we just talked because you were on the Friday show. I feel like it hasn't been a long, super long time since I've talked to you. But how was your weekend regardless?
Weekend was good. Weekend is good. Yeah, nothing to complain about. It's so funny because I'm actually like, let's not talk about the weekend. I want to get to the Gates story.
It's a good one today. And yeah. I'm feeling extra feisty today. So we've got some clips. The script has been punched up sufficiently. I think everyone's going to enjoy what we have to say today, although there is some not the best news in the world as well. But we're going to bring the news to you the best we can. It is my free day. I have now 2 weeks from my second dose.
Woo!
Of Pfizer.
Congratulations.
So I can go out and lick doorknobs, but I will not. I will continue to wear my mask and be socially distant. Although, you know, things are starting to gradually, like there's some like patio karaoke at Urban Moe's that I might go check out, you know. I'm feeling a little more like I can start creeping out into the world, you know, with my mask and, you know, with the, you know, everything else. But it's just the weather's beautiful. I don't know. I'm feeling more hopeful.
Good.
And join us this week on Stereo, Andrew, at Andrew AG on Tuesday at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, and Dana AG on Thursdays, 5, 8. See, that's how I'm going to get around the Dana and me, Dana and I, Andrew and I.
There you go.
I'll just be Andrew AG and Dana AG, AGDG. So later on in the show, too, I got to have a really quite an in-depth conversation with former acting director of the FBI, Andy McCabe, about all this new information and that tidbit of new evidence we got from the U.S. Treasury Department about Kilimnik and what he did with the sensitive voter/polling data he got from Manafort, from the Trump campaign, etc. So we'll be talking about that and the implications there. So it's going to be a great show. So I'm looking forward to it, and I'm happy to talk to you. I missed you over the weekend, my friend.
You too. And if you don't follow AG on Twitter, you should, because the interview, you have the cartography of the interview with McCabe. If you're following AG, where she put her notes up, it's worth a follow. It really is.
I did. It's at Mueller. She wrote. I put my notes up every time I talk to McCabe. It's just this disjointed sort of pictogram without pictures. It's hard to explain my thought process. Maybe someone who is an expert can explain it to me. I don't know. It's just, you could see what my brain looks like on paper. All right. We have a lot of news to get to. Let's do this. Let's hit the hot notes. Hot notes. All right, lead story today. One of the founding members of the Oath Keepers, John Schaefer, pled guilty Friday and agreed to cooperate against others in the case. He is the first defendant to publicly flip in the sprawling domestic terrorism investigation that has led to charges against more than 410 people. And I want to emphasize the word that they sort of glossed over this in the article, but they said first defendant to publicly flip in the sprawling domestic terrorism investigation. I emphasize publicly because there's been a few criminal information documents filed in the investigation. And as we know, criminal investigation documents can be an indicator of a plea agreement. I'll talk about that a little bit more. It doesn't necessarily guarantee one. But Schaefer is the first publicly known cooperator in the investigation. The plea marks a new stage in the historic investigation as prosecutors seek to work up the chain of defendants to gather evidence and better understand the scope and any planning and organizing of the violence, particularly among white supremacist groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. Now, Schaefer, 53, a guitarist and lead songwriter for the heavy metal band Iced Earth, abandoned his pet tarantula and imaginary girlfriend when he was arrested for his crimes against the United States.
I feel like that was just like a weird political Mad Lib where you filled in nouns and verbs and adverbs where you're like, a guitarist, lead singer, heavy metal, tarantula. What?
The tarantula and imaginary girlfriend were my special additions to that.
Why don't you take Allison to one of your heavy metal vomit parties?
No, thank you. Anyway, Schaefer was charged Friday by criminal information. As I said earlier, I mentioned that's the type of charging document used when a defendant waives the right to an indictment. And other insurrectionists have been charged in this manner as well, though Heavy Metal Vomit Man is the first public cooperator that we know of. He was initially charged with six crimes, including engaging in an act of physical violence and targeting police with bear spray. But he's pled down to just two charges, obstruction of an official proceeding of Congress and trespassing on restricted grounds of the Capitol while armed with a deadly or dangerous weapon. Under the terms of the plea deal signed by Schaefer and his attorney, he now faces a recommended prison term of 41 to 51 months under non-binding federal guidelines, though his sentence will ultimately be decided by the judge. And these things are fluid. More charges could come. He could blow up his plea deal. They might not get anything from him. He could bring really important information and plead down to one charge. Everything is fluid. We don't know what's going to happen here, but we'll keep you posted on it. And the FBI and the Justice Department have hit about a dozen members of and associates of the anti-government group, the Oath Keepers, with conspiracy charges for allegedly planning and preparing the violence ahead of the insurrection. I don't buy that they need this guy's cooperation to prove that, so I don't know that he's necessarily there to roll on other Oath Keepers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That leaves a big question, right? Is he going to roll on other Oath Keepers and Proud Boys to help prosecutors pursue those seditious conspiracy or even RICO charges? Or is he going to roll on bigger fish like Roger Stone? I don't know, but we'll stay on top of it. But look for more assholes to start flipping. We don't know.
Totally, because usually little fish don't roll on little fish. Little fish roll on bigger fish.
Right, yeah. Or same-sized fish. Or if they're doing seditious conspiracy and they want to prove RICO, they might need him for that.
Right.
Who knows? We'll learn more about it. And in related news, Rachel Powell, the insurrection octomom charged in connection with the attack on the Capitol, is in hot water with a federal judge after wearing a see-through mesh mask to the bookstore where she worked, which would normally just be indicative of being a reckless asshole, but in this case, it was in defiance of a judge's order. Quote, defendant's decision to appear in a video wearing a mask with holes in it at work mocks compliance with the court's order setting as a condition of pretrial release that she wear a mask whenever she leaves her residence. That's a statement from U.S. District Judge Royce Lamberth. Go on, Judge. He says, no reasonable person could think that a defendant's mask complied with that condition, which Chief Justice Beryl Howell imposed to ensure the defendant would not pose a risk to the health and safety of the community when she left her house. Lamberth continues, the court does not take the defendant's willingness to flout the court's order lightly and ordered Powell to show cause in writing no longer than 10 days from this date, which was Friday, why the court should not revoke her pretrial release, order her detained pending trial, or hold her in contempt. So now she has to write an essay. She has 10 days to write an essay about why she's an insufferable asshole. I don't know, though. If they didn't snap back Roger Stone for posting that photo of Judge Beryl Howell behind crosshairs, I'm not sure they'll slap the shackles on Octomom.
I'm with you.
But if it were up to me, though, she'd be back in prison tomorrow because not wearing a mask is a danger to the public. And it wasn't just wear a mask and then you can wear a mask with holes in it. You know, it was to prevent, you know, for public safety, for the health and well-being of others. So it was explained why the mask needed to be worn and she flouted that. So we'll see what happens.
Lock her up. Is there anything? Lock her up. All right. Speaking of locking people up, I would love this woman to end up behind bars. Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar in Arizona are starting, as we said at the top of the hour, they're trying to start a right-wing Ku Klux caucus in Congress that seeks to, quote, follow in the former guy's footsteps. It says his name. I don't wanna. Which could prove yet another thorn in the side of Republican leaders already struggling against being labeled as white nationalists. That seems to be a problem.
Yeah, it already said, the story actually said Republican leaders struggling against division in their party. And I was like, no, that's not what they're struggling against.
No, not at all. They're struggling against being labeled Nazis. According to a 7-page policy platform published say that five times fast, by Punch Bowl News. The group wants members to display, quote, a certain intellectual boldness and be willing to step on some toes and sacrifice sacred cows, which is the weirdest fucking statement, let's be honest. A lengthy passage on immigration says the U.S. is, quote, a nation with a border and a culture strengthened by a common respect for uniquely Anglo-Saxon political traditions, which is, quote, threatened when foreign citizens are imported en masse. Jesus Christ.
But what about foreign Anglo-Saxon citizens?
Because, you know, apparently they forget that this land wasn't always your land and my land. This land belonged to Native Americans. Under the, quote, infrastructure, the platform promotes, quote, architectural engineering and aesthetic value that benefits the progeny of European architecture, echoing the former guy's now revoked executive order banning many modern architectural styles for federal government buildings.
Yeah, I don't know. It just sounds like infrastructure platform, architectural engineering and aesthetic value that benefits the progeny of European architecture. That sounds like breeding to me. That sounds like a kind of like a metaphor for the architecture of the people of this country. And that freaks me out.
100%. 100%. And this will come as no shock to you, but apparently that guy, Matt Gaetz in Florida, you know, the one under federal investigation for an alleged sexual relationship with a 17-year-old. Well, he tweeted that he's proud to be joining the caucus. So Matt Gaetz is totally into the caucus on that one. But this just in, AG, we got news on this story. Apparently Green and Gosar are distancing themselves already from their own idiot caucus. Yes. So Gosar said in a Saturday statement that he did not author this. I did not author the document, in the one that's in circulation, and only became aware of it after it was reported by the news media, and added that, quote, he will continue to work on America First issues in the House Freedom Caucus. So all of a sudden, don't know who wrote that. He didn't author it. Don't know where it came from. And then he says, let me be perfectly clear. I did not author this paper. In fact, I first became aware of it by reading about it in the news yesterday, like everyone else. Bullshit. Additionally, Nick Dyer, a spokesperson for Marjorie Taylor Greene, said in a statement that the document was merely an early planning proposal and nothing was agreed upon or approved.
Oh.
She went on to say the document was, quote, a staff-level draft proposal from an outside group that I hadn't read. So they didn't read it, supposedly, before they started promoting this very racist idea.
Yeah. It's going to get to one of those 51st dates in the cafe scenes where she's just like, I can't read, and that will be her defense, you know. And oh my god, Matt,
speaking of Matt Gaetz, tell me,
oh my god, Matt Gaetz's former girlfriend has told Friends that she's worried that the woman who's central to the federal sex crimes investigation tried to get her to incriminate Matt on a recorded phone call.
My best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend heard from this guy who knows this kid is going with the girl who saw Ferris pass out at 31 Flavors last night. I guess it's pretty serious.
And it actually is pretty serious for Matt Gaetz. This revelation raises the possibility that federal prosecutors now have two top cooperating witnesses. The woman who was an alleged sex trafficking victim when she was a minor, and Gaetz's best bro tax man, former Seminole County tax collector Joel Greenberg. Gaetz's former girlfriend has played a bit role in the unfolding public drama. She is the woman, by the way, who sent Gaetz a nude video of her performing a hula hoop dance that he has since showed to other members of Congress. But two of her friends, who declined to be identified publicly because they're trying to keep a low profile, says she now suspects she was being set up when an alleged victim and another woman involved in the case called her to discuss Matt in what she fears might have been a recorded conference call. The call took place sometime after Greenberg was indicted for the sex crimes in August. Now, I've done a little research. I found that Florida is a two-party consent state, meaning you cannot record someone without their consent. D.C., however, is a one-party consent state. I don't know what it means if you're calling from a two-party to a one-party, and it's not a state, I know, but I'm willing it into existence.
Absolutely.
Or if the call goes from the other way, and I don't know where the parties were at the time, but I imagine if you're working with the feds and they have a warrant to record the call, I'm thinking you're shit out of luck. So these two friends did not provide details about exactly what was discussed, but one recounted that Gaetz's ex-girlfriend said she was opposed to talking to authorities and is now worried the prosecutors might try to charge her with obstructing justice in order to roll her up on Matt Gaetz. All three women on the call were on that Bahamas trip, currently under investigation. And a different mutual friend said, quote, Tallahassee is like high school, but no one ever graduates.
Wow. Gross. Speaking of disgusting people, the Justice Department filed a civil lawsuit against the former guy's ally, Roger Stone. Man, he's been in a lot of trouble lately. This was on Friday, accusing him and his wife of owing nearly $2 million in unpaid taxes, AG. Yes, this is a 6-count civil complaint. Investigators said Stone and his wife, Nydia Stone, owed about $1.5 million in unpaid taxes from 2007 and 2011, and an additional $407,000 from just 2018 alone. And this is a quote. The Stones evaded and frustrated the IRS's collection efforts by repeatedly funneling money to a corporate entity they controlled called Drake Ventures. That's what the investigator said. So Stone and his wife then used Drake Ventures, that account, to, quote, fund a lavish lifestyle despite owing nearly $2 million in unpaid taxes, interest, and penalties. So according to this complaint, the Stones allegedly used this Drake Ventures account to pay for personal expenses like spa visits, haircuts, groceries, restaurants, dentist appointments.
Dentist appointments.
Dentist appointments. Yep, covered those. And this is what Stone said. And the government statement is preposterous, Stone said in a statement to CNN. They're well aware that my 2-year struggle against the epically corrupt Mueller investigation has left my wife and I on the verge of bankruptcy. First of all, you moron, it's my wife and me, so there's that.
Woohoo! Woo! Yep.
Thank you very much. And then he went on to say, I've continued to eke out a living through my company Drake Ventures. To describe my current lifestyle as lavish would be proved to be ridiculous in court. The political motivation of the DOJ will be abundantly clear at trial. Dun dun dun.
Oh my god. Eke out a living through Drake Ventures.
I know.
And every time they're like the Stones when they talk about him and his wife, I'm like, Mick Jagger, oh my god. I just keep thinking. Then Keith Richards is like, what the fuck, man? Somewhere. Oh, just man. Really upset. Yeah, the good old epically corrupt Mueller investigation.
Mm-hmm. Mm. That keeps being proven right over and over and over.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of which, we'll be right back with former acting director of the FBI during the oranges of the Russia probe, Andy McCabe. So stay with us.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I am joined today by former acting director of the FBI and author of the book, The Threat. Please welcome Andrew McCabe. Andy, how are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm great. How's the family? How's the kids? How's Jill? Is everybody vaxxed and ready to go?
Yeah. So Jill and I are, and my son just got vaccinated. My daughter will, I think, in the next couple of weeks. They're both away at school and doing really well. Everybody stayed healthy. Anxious to kind of get back out into the world, like I'm sure everyone else is. But yeah, we're doing good. Thank you for asking.
Yeah, of course. And I'm wondering too. I know that a bunch of colleges are now starting to say that you can't come back to in-person learning in the fall if you're not vaccinated. And I personally think that's a good way to go. But it's only a handful of schools at this point. We'll see how it goes. But I'm glad that you guys are doing well.
Thanks.
Now, the reason I have you here today is because, gosh, all of a sudden, Mueller, She Wrote is relevant again. I wrote a thread in May of 2018 about Manafort on August 2nd, 2016, meeting with Kilimnik at the Grand Havana Cigar Room in Kushner's Devil Building, which is 666 Fifth Avenue.
It's so theatrical. I mean, you can just imagine it, right?
Right. And then, of course, Deripaska's plane lands. There's a flight, pick up a prime minister. They go onto a boat, which is a yacht, really, let's be honest. And I remember Nastya Rybka filming on this boat and Navalny actually releasing those tapes. And you know, I had said, I think there's going to be superseding indictments on Manafort. This is collusion. This is what you're talking about. This is precisely what the definition is. But then when the Mueller report came out, Mueller said, yep, the stuff was handed over, and then Gates was responsible for handing the stuff over, but we don't know what happened to it afterwards. And I want to sort of ask you why he wasn't able to sort of cross that line. I think it might have something to do with what he also mentioned in his report, which was a lot of people lied to us.
That's right. That's right. And he points that out specifically with respect to Manafort. He says in that chapter where he's detailing the exchanges of internal polling data and things like that through Gates to Kilimnik, Mueller points out that Manafort can't be relied on, that Manafort lied to the special counsel and to the grand jury about these matters. And at the end of the day, Manafort he claimed he couldn't remember any specific directions that he gave to Kilimnik about why the polling data would be beneficial and where it should go and that sort of thing. So it's pretty clear that, the special counsel team didn't believe Manafort at that point, but that's a pretty big step short of having solid evidence that he lied or covered up a conspiracy.
Yeah, right. Because we know I was reading Weissman's book and they were like, we did have enough to get Manafort on conspiracy. However, we had all this tax fraud and business fraud, and we were able to connect it, 10-year-old tax fraud to current conspiracy. And so we were able to charge this. And that was just easier because we had all the documentary evidence.
That's right.
And Rick Gates, I think they were, and this is just conjecture, but I think they were concerned that he wouldn't be a very reliable witness because he himself is pretty much a dirtball. But that sort of we learned that to be true. There was a juror who had to rely solely on the documents and not on what Gates said, and that's where that hung jury came on some of the counts. But that particular juror was like, but the documents don't lie. And so, I have a feeling that they sort of kind of decided not to prosecute because, first of all, it's a really high bar to go down that route.
Yeah, criminal conspiracy, which is, of course, what Mueller was trying to prove, not collusion specifically, which collusion is not really a crime. Criminal conspiracy is the crime. And to prove a criminal conspiracy, you have to have evidence of an agreement. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean like written down, I, Paul Manafort, agree to engage in the following criminal acts with you, Vladimir Putin. That would be nice if we had that, but we didn't. But you have to have evidence of an exchange of benefit, acting in concert. Also, there's different types of evidence that you can use to prove the agreement, but at the end of the day, you have to have it. It's a pretty high bar. And in this case, we knew that Manafort had given polling data over to Kilimnik. We knew that Kilimnik had, as Mueller describes it, had ties to Russian intelligence, but they couldn't show the end of that line of logic, that Kilimnik had actually delivered the material to the Russian intelligence service. And that's the difference with the revelation we got this week. It seems with the Treasury Department's public statement about the sanctions that the Biden administration imposed on Russia this week, they are very clearly calling out Kilimnik for having provided that specific polling data to the Russian intelligence services. So they have, I'm fairly confident in this assumption that the government is sitting on some incontrovertible evidence that material made its way into the hands of the FSB.
Yeah. And I feel like I've talked to a ton of, former prosecutors and federal prosecutors, former U.S. attorneys who say, we've convicted on less. We've convicted criminal conspiracy on less. And when you consider the totality of the evidence in the Mueller investigation, seems like a slam dunk. Is choosing not to prosecute that more of a conservative choice, do you think? Because is it the level or the exposure of the case?
Yeah, I think, I think they made many very conservative choices in the way that they talked about their evidence, in the way they talked about possible charges, and in the charges they brought. I think that I would expect that Mueller would only bring absolutely unassailable cases forward, and not wanting to risk looking like they were out on a headhunting expedition or trying to make political headlines or anything like that. I think Mueller probably held them to a very, very high bar of only bringing cases that were absolutely undeniable on the evidence. So the ones that were a little shakier, and there's always well, I'd say prosecutors love to say, oh, if I had that evidence, I would have brought that charge. You know, that's, it's easy to be bold when it's not actually your case. So some of those comments are a little bit hyperbolic, but nevertheless, a more aggressive prosecutor may have decided to bring that stuff forward.
Yeah. But then you're walking that fine line of being constantly under the threat of being fired.
Sure.
And then you wouldn't have been able to put out any work product, and we wouldn't have that really nice, crisp, delicious volume two that we got. Although I think Mueller is a volume one guy. I'm a volume two person. I think he was a volume one guy, but I think he wanted to get all that information out there. It was just railroaded by Rosenstein and Barr. And when you talk about that, there, you don't have any proof of this. You don't know for sure, but you speculate that there's probably some irrefutable evidence now that they're able to make that statement. Does that mean that this investigation could continue? I don't know. I mean, Manafort has this kind of blanket pardon for anything that came out of the Mueller investigation. But if Mueller didn't have that evidence, I don't know that that counts.
Well, you know, it would be really hard, I think, to hold Manafort accountable for anything related to this conduct. At this point, with the pardon in his pocket, it's a very powerful tool. However, these are incredibly significant underlying matters, right? The fact that Konstantin Kilimnik is a Russian agent, essentially working in concert with the Russian intelligence services, delivering sensitive campaign information to them. Like, the FBI is not going to forget about him. They're not going to forget about the people that he interacts with. Even though he's not here, he's someone who will be kind of, go down in the annals of FBI foreign counterintelligence work as a Russian agent to be taken very seriously. So that sort of investigation goes on. The FBI never stops looking away from the Russian target set. And the more that we find out from this series of events, the more light we shed on that threat.
Yeah, concur. Now, you mentioned sanctions. I do have a couple questions about sanctions, but I have to take a really quick break. Will you stay with me?
Of course.
Oh, thank you so much. We'll be right back, everybody.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Everybody, welcome back. We're talking to former acting director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe. And seriously, you need to read his book, The Threat. It will give you so much information on a bunch of new stuff that I think is about to come out that will really kind of help you understand the oranges of Crossfire Hurricane, how the FBI operates. And I mean, it's just an outstanding book. So I recommend picking it up. It's called The Threat. Now, before the break, you had mentioned the sanctions that we just slapped on Russia. We gave them sanctions.
Yes.
For the SolarWinds hack, for interfering in 2020, not necessarily for the Russian bounties, because they're still looking into that, or they didn't say it didn't happen.
Right.
They didn't say it did happen. And so now, regarding these sanctions, they expelled some Russian diplomats. Every time we hear about some Russian sanctions going down or the Russians do something, we respond. We're always expelling diplomats. And they say they're expelling them because it turns out they're actually probably spies, right? And so my number one question every time they do this, and forgive me if I sound completely naive on this because I just don't understand it, is if you knew that they were intelligence agents for Russia, why did you let them stay? Do we let them stay, monitor them? I mean, I've seen, the Americans, but do we just kind of let them do their thing, monitor them, because that's how we can gather intelligence and sort of save them up in a hopper until we have to retaliate against Russia? And then, bam, we've got some people to expel. What's that process?
Well, it's a really fascinating and complicated, multifaceted process, investigation, like a never-ending inquiry that the FBI maintains on the presence of potential Russian agents here in the United States. And of course, I have to be very careful about how what I reveal in this answer. So I may be a little, forgive me for being a little bit obtuse or academic here, but one place that you would, the most obvious place that you would look to see if there was Russian malign intelligence activity taking place here would quite obviously be the embassy. So that is something that happens every day. The Bureau is constantly trying to get better information on exactly who's there and what they might be up to. If in the course of that inquiry, you find someone who you think is actually engaged in intelligence gathering activity, there's a couple of things you might do. You might build a case against them. You might indict them for committing espionage if they were in fact doing that, and try to prosecute them and throw them in jail. Or you might bring that evidence together and use it to decide to kick them out of the country, a process that we call persona non grata, or referred to as PNG. So you could do that as well. Or you might just take advantage of it as an opportunity to watch that person go through their work and to develop a more rich and detailed understanding of what the Russians are interested in, right? So if you know what an intelligence officer is doing here, that reveals essentially the intents, the plans of the hostile foreign power that officer is working for. So it can be a great intelligence collection opportunity, or you can use it as a diplomatic tool with PNG, or you can just use it to throw someone in jail for violating the laws of the United States. Now, the PNG process, you have to go into it knowing that whatever steps we take against Russian diplomats here, that's going to be at least mirrored by Russian activity in Russia. So if we kick out a few of theirs, that they're going to respond by kicking out at least the same number of ours.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that too, because now Merrick Garland, for example, is not allowed to set foot in Russia. Susan Rice, who tweeted a very hilarious photo of just this remote kind of like shack, and she's like, "Oh darn, there goes my Airbnb vacation in Siberia." but yeah, that's sort of the tit for tat, right? And I from my understanding, or at least the readouts of the calls that Biden has had with Putin. By the way, how nice is it to get readouts of calls with the president and Putin? It's night and day. But you know, I think he
so strangely professional.
I know,
and normal,
I think,
right?
He was saying, you know, we're not going full crazy on this right now, because you know we're yeah. But we have to respond, and we're looking at you on this. And I mean, you know, it's kind of, it's towing this very tenuous line.
Yeah, it really is. It was an interesting move they took. He'd been taking some criticism, and rightly so, for not being harsh enough. But I think I get the sense he's trying to leave the door open to possibly have the summit meeting with Putin in the next few months and try to start to normalize things a little bit. Of all the sanctions, the ones that they really care about are the ones that hurt them economically. Sanctioning individuals, I mean, they can't travel here anymore. That's just really kind of, you know, for publicity value, nobody really cares about that. But when you hurt the Russians in their pocketbook, you have done some damage. The most significant for my money is the one that prohibits American banks from purchasing Russian debt. It's not a complete block on Russian indirect access to the U.S. financial system, but it's like the first step in that direction. So you can imagine if they had decided to go tougher, or if they decide to do that in the future, which is always possible, you could be looking at a situation like Iran, right, where they just cannot conduct any financial transactions that come through American banks or American institutions. And we could even start penalizing other countries' financial institutions for doing business with Russia. You could isolate them in a very, very damaging way economically. And I'm sure that's lurking in the back of Putin's head now.
Right. And that's precisely what we did with Iran. And we caught Malaysia circumventing those sanctions.
That's right.
And indicted several of those. Oddly, friends of Rudy Giuliani. Okay. Now, finally, are these Magnitsky sanctions? Does the OFAC list, which is the, you know, the list that the Treasury Department keeps of all the sanctions, is that specifically for Magnitsky sanctions, or are there different kinds of sanctions under different laws?
There are different sources of sanctions, and Magnitsky is a separate law that was passed by Congress, specifically in the wake of the torture and killing of Sergei Magnitsky. And so it is meant to be directed at those sorts of human rights abuses. And there's a process with it that's kind of unique from the typical OFAC sanctions, in which Congress can make a demand on the administration to provide a report about the potential, you know, violation of the Magnitsky Act. They made such a demand to the Trump administration, and the Trump administration just ignored it. So hopefully...
Right.
We have a different approach to that in the future. But it's a different kind of a set of sanctions based on a different law.
Yeah, because these aren't humanitarian violations. These are strictly hacking, you know.
That's right. That's right. So Congress actually invoked the Magnitsky Act after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And, you know, that sets in motion this process where I think the administration gets 60 days to comprise a report and report back to Congress as to what they think happened. And then that could lead to sanctions. But as I said, the Trump administration just ignored the request. And
But Avril Haines said, I'll follow the law. And she actually has turned that over.
That's exactly right.
So, yeah. And now with we see what's going on with Navalny. And I think that is... It smacks of what happened to Magnitsky to me. I mean, it's just carbon copies in the same penal colony.
Yeah. I mean, look, the president was right when he said that Vladimir Putin is a killer. He is a killer. The government of Russia pursues a policy of international assassinations as if it were like, you know, trade negotiations or something. That is just a part of who they are as a government. And so I think that this you know, what they've done to Navalny is kind of consistent with that approach. They just eliminate people who they think are damaging or dangerous to the political success and survival of the president.
Now, one last question before I let you go. I don't know if you can answer this, but it's the question I get the most often about Russia. Why was Semyon Mogilevich taken off the top 10 most wanted list?
I cannot answer that question for you.
All right, I figured as much. Now, tell me everything you know. No, I'm just...
I know less and less every day. I'm successfully forgetting more and more all the time.
Well done. And I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much for coming and talking. There's just so much, I think, that's going to be revealed. I don't know that we're going to get the prosecutions we wish we would have gotten. But the truth is important as well.
It is. And I'm so appreciative of your undying interest in it and your audience's continued interest in it. It is so important that we get to the bottom of these things. And every time we chip away and expose another fact, we undermine this nonsensical, maniacal claim of, oh, it was all a hoax. We know very well it wasn't a hoax. The investigation, the prospect that the campaign may have been working in concert with Russian intelligence. And so we just continue chipping away at it and shed a little bit more light on what was truly going on there. So I think it's great that people are still interested in it.
Yeah. And I was kind of hoping we would say adios to Durham based on this information, but I guess he's still around puttering around. Anyway, I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. Everybody pick up The Threat, such an important book. And I appreciate your time today. Former acting director of the FBI, Andy McCabe. Have a great day.
Thanks so much.
Everybody stick around. We'll be right back with the good news.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Everybody, welcome back. It's time for the good news.
Who likes good news? Everyone? Then good news, everyone!
Good news, good news. Well, that was a hell of an interview. So I appreciate Andy coming and talking to us.
He is a good man.
He really is. Just super kind. And his family is awesome as well. All right, we have good news. If you have good news, corrections, we're playing a million games, right?
So many games.
What the Mutt. Send us your favorite swear word.
Twister, you can't see us playing it, but we're doing it.
Yes, misheard lyrics. Mondegreen, right?
Yeah.
Lady Mondegreen. And anything you want to send us, and but especially like corrections, I want to make sure I get everything right. And there's a lot of legal stuff that I went over in this episode. So you just do all that at dailybeanspod.com and click on contact. And we first start this off with a correction. Multiple listeners wanted to make sure AG knows how to pronounce San Luis Obispo. Lewis rhymes with poopiss, not Louis rhymes with poopy. Or if you want to go the whole brevity route, slow works. Well, yeah, I could go slow. So it's San Luis.
I really love that this person, and listen, thank you for all the corrections, but instead of saying like St. Louis, they said rhymes with poopiss.
Yes. San Luis Obispo?
San Luis Obispo.
Oh, all right.
I actually didn't know that either, so now I can say it correctly as well, so don't look. But I do actually use the slow. S-L-O, slow.
Yeah, I'm just going to call it slow from now on. That'll fix everything.
All right, well, we'll get the correction out of the way. Yeah, and let's get to the good news. So we got Jesse pronounce he, him, and there's an included tax. So two shots for my daily hikes to the top of, I'm going to assume it's Cerro San Luis. Sarah San Luis, or San Louis. I think it's San Luis. And a pet tax of our Frenchie Cobalt. Now, we think he may have been trying to make friends with the statue. The photo of the mountain is in the Bishop's Peak, part of Nine Sisters in Slough. And the other is just a spectacular sunrise from Cerro San Luis. I included them as they brighten my day, so hopefully they brighten yours too. Cheers, ladies, and thank you for everything you do. These pictures, especially the second one, looks like something from Hawaii, are absolutely stunning.
Oh.
And the dog, the Frenchie, trying to make friends with the statue is adorable.
I love their little like Popeye the Sailor Man butt leg combination.
Right?
It's just so adorable.
So cute.
All right, next up from Portia, she, her, had the same correction, plus this. One time I asked my Aunt Libby if she'd lip my lipper. She giggled and told me it was called a zipper. With this information, I confidently asked her, Aunt Zibby, would you zip my zipper? Also, here in the South, we have a giant flying bird-like roach. These things are nightmares. They're the things nightmares are made of. Don't let anyone tell you they're palmetto or water bugs. They're giant flying cockroaches.
Thank you.
So my son tells me he doesn't like all of the cocks outside right now.
Same, kiddo. Same.
He said, I like to call cockroaches cocks. That was an uncomfortable correction for him. I love your show. I listen to every episode. You all help keep me sane in this insanity. We still have a long way to go, so may the odds be ever in our favor. Here's my pet tax, our rescue dogs. Bullet is the large male, and Ray is the black female. She was found a block from where we found Bullet. Bullet is jealous of my male cat and everything. He's my bestie. Ray is as sweet as pie and jumps straight up when she's excited, repeatedly. Love them both. So glad they adopted us. Guess what they are?
Okay.
Oh, that's a...
First one. I see...
Rottweiler.
I see Rottweiler, Shepherd, and also some Beagle.
And there's probably like Schnauzer in there because that doesn't look anything like it.
And the second...
Oh, the girl is
a
lab. So
that's Bullet.
That looks like a Rottie too.
A baby Rott. Yeah, I would say a Rott. And ooh, it looks like there's some markings. So I would say Australian in there, like almost like a red heeler. You see?
Yeah, or a blue heeler.
Yeah. So Australian Shepherd dog in there. And Ray.
Gosh. Yeah, that's a pretty square head on that dog.
Yeah.
Maybe Boxer. All right, let's see.
Answer.
Ray's breed percentage. Pitbull, Chow Chow, Cocker Spaniel, Korean Jindo, Shetland Sheepdog, and Terrier Guard Herding. 25% breed groups. Okay.
Well, it's the first one. American Stud.
I thought Ray was the big...
Well, they're marked. So Ray's the last one.
Ray. Oh, okay. And then the other one is Pitbull, Australian Shepherd. You got it. Chow Chow, German Shepherd Dog, Rottweiler. Ooh, we got like three.
We did well on that one.
Awesome. What's up?
Cute.
No Schnauzer.
Oh my God. We just have to every once in a while just hope that we're right. Okay.
Yeah, and there's Chow Chows get around.
Right?
They're in a lot of dogs.
They're in a lot of dogs. All right. We'll do this next one. I'll take it. Annie, pronouns she and her. Hi to AG, DG, and AC on all the other Beans Queens. I'd like to share some of my favorite swears. I enjoy calling bad drivers turkey butts. Annie, watch your language. I also used it for the former guy. I try to be polite. However, I have been known to say... you can fold it in four corners and stick it where the moon don't shine. I'll use horse hockey instead of bullshit. My mom tried not to swear, but would say, son of a sea dog, every now and again. This is the most innocent swear share I've ever heard.
I know.
I thought you were saying pod text instead of pod tax. So attached are pictures of my two rescue pets, mother and daughter, Millie and Tilly. They are senior dogs, but don't act like it. Oh, gosh, they're cute.
Oh, and their little bed and their little feet over the...
Little ballerina feet.
And the ears.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's so cute.
All right, AG, you've got a long one, but a good one. So take it away.
Yeah, this is a note I received. This is good news. And it starts with AG, because I still can't call you Allison. I have listened to MSW from the beginning, from the kitchen table days to today. You are part of my morning every weekday morning. I have appreciated your in-depth dives on the Mueller investigation, the book clubs, and the news with swears. But most of all, I think I need to thank you for a reminder to take care of my mental health. I have been anxious and suffered with depression since I was a child, but my strict evangelical upbringing meant I got punished for it and never given any counseling or medication because, quote, people will think you're crazy, unquote. I carried that internalized stigma through college, through grad school, through the death of my mom, and through my dad's mental break and going no contact with him. I managed to mask most of my issues through it all. I married my amazing husband in 2008, and we suffered through years of infertility. We finally found out in April of 2013 we were expecting our daughter. But then our anatomy ultrasound turned from joy to horror and a flood of specialist appointments. It showed our baby had a severe congenital heart defects and heterotaxy syndrome, which means her body organs are misplaced, malformed, or missing. She has medical issues with her heart, lungs, airways, intestines, kidneys, and liver, and she's missing her spleen. We were told she had just a 15% chance of living to age one and only a 5% chance of living to age five. Savannah had two huge open heart surgeries before she was two and became 100% pacemaker dependent. I watched her code in front of me and nearly lost her multiple times. I went through all that with no mental health care, still clinging to that stigma that I would be seen as crazy and that I needed to hide my anxiety as much as possible. I continued living deep in the pit of depression and became incredibly and increasingly anxious when the former guy was elected. You see, my daughter only survived her first 3 years of life because of the Affordable Care Act. Her list of pre-existing conditions is pages long, and her medical bills top $3 million. She's well past lifetime caps. We are only not completely bankrupt because of maximum out-of-pockets. I was terrified they would repeal the Affordable Care Act and sign my daughter's death sentence. Her care is unaffordable without insurance. I started listening to MSW and loved hearing the evolution of the podcast over time. You, Jordan, Mandy, DG, and Amy have become friends I've never met. You spoke openly about mental health issues from the beginning, which was what gave me the ability to be more open and honest with my husband about my anxiety and depression. Then you added, "Take care of your mental health," to your tagline, and every day that reminder came through my headphones. Then COVID hit, and it hit us exceptionally hard. We had to go on total isolation. No family, no friends, everything delivered, wiping down groceries with bleach wipes and quarantining for 72 hours, no eating out, no curbside pickup, no drive-through, total home quarantine. In the midst of it all, our HVAC gave out, and we struggled financially because of medical bills, but that was the straw that, for whatever reason, broke my emotional and mental health's back. I had anxiety so bad I had chest pains, end on end, for days. I was so deep in depression I couldn't even cry anymore. I often couldn't sleep, and when I did, it wasn't restful. I started to grit my teeth to get through it as I always had, but there you were, every day, telling me to take care of my mental health. And so I scheduled a telemedicine visit with my primary care physician, and I told a medical professional what my mental health was really like for the first time. I started therapy, I saw a psych, I got medication. It's been about a year now. My mental health is not perfect, but I am better now than I have ever been in my whole adult life, and probably my childhood too. I couldn't remember what it felt like to be a functional person, and now I'm a functional person most days. I no longer spend every day at the bottom of the depression pit. I don't have the never-ending anxiety every day. I smile, I laugh, I enjoy life. I enjoy my miracle of a daughter who is seven now. Literally the first wave of heterotaxy kids to survive this long, thanks to pioneering cardiothoracic surgery. And I have you to thank for so much of it. That voice every day telling me to take care of me and take care of my mental health helped me bury my learned stigma and make a change. So thank you for the pods and for your reminders and for your company through this pandemic. Please keep reminding us all to take care of our mental health. It makes a difference. I'm pretty sure it saved me. Signed, Lori.
Hey, G, thank you for sharing that with us. I know that it wasn't easy for either of you.
But I reached out. She said it was okay to share this because she thought it could help, even if it just helped one person. You know, and I have very different circumstances, yeah. But I know what it's like to be in that cryless bottom of the pit with no light at the end of the tunnel, you know?
Yeah. And I'm glad that you've been able to get yourself out of it. And I'm very glad, Lori. Lori, I am so glad that whatever it took, whether it's AG's voice or your own courage and your own strength, because you have to remember that was inside you the entire time. It was triggered by something you heard. So just please take great pride in the fact that that was always inside you. And always will be on the days where you don't feel as strong. So, yeah. My goodness.
And that makes you a warrior.
Indeed.
Okay, well, we're going to end on that note. And I'll never stop saying it. Everyone, please take care of yourselves, take care of each other, take care of the planet, and take care of your mental health. I've been AG.
And I've been DG.
And them's the beans.
Refried beans. I like refried beans.